We gather this morning, and I continue what I began last week as the message that I want to present to you. When we first began, there were questions that were asked, and I still hear those same questions being asked today. What's ahead? What's next? Where are we going? Now, one might conclude from that we haven't gone anywhere, or we don't have a clue about our direction or our goals. But I actually have another thought about it, and that's what I want to share with you this morning. These are questions that human beings ask because human beings live in time. We'll always ask these questions, and we always have asked them, and you never can really reach a final, definitive answer about where we're going, what's ahead, especially when we are oriented to the future. The final frontier, if I might borrow from Captain James T. Kirk of the original Star Trek series, these are the voyages of the modern human enterprise. Its lifelong mission, to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life and new civilizations, and to boldly go where no man has gone before. That's our culture. That's the Western world. That's what's ahead. That's what's next, and then next, and next. It keeps moving. That's where we're headed, the future. So keep going. You can't miss it. Full speed ahead. This is the way we live. And we live from, okay, that was that, but what's next? And then that was that, well, what's next? And we live that way. And it's so deeply ingrained in us, we don't realize it. We never think about it, and certainly would never, ever question it. Time is a linear sequence in the way we view it and live it. There's first the past, and then there's the present, which means the past is past. Then there's the future. Everybody knows this. We used to be in the past, now we're in the present. Wait a minute, it just became past while I've said that. It's now behind us. We need to move on. We're always on the brink of the future and moving into it, making this present, as soon as it is present, past. It's always the future, and then the future, and the future, and the future. And that's how we live. But it's even more than that. Being moderns, as I said last week, having marinated in 500 years of modernity, we have inherited a deep-seated anti-past bias. In other words, we're against the past. Get over it. Put it behind you. Leave it behind. It's time to move on. Don't want to hinder your progress by going back for any reason. There's no reason to look back because nothing back there can teach you anything. There's nothing to learn. There's nothing of truth or value in the past. It's inferior. It's regressive. It can't be authoritative for us. We live now, not then. And so all we need and all we have is right here in the present. Just now coming off our assembly lines and our online store shelves, fresh out of our laboratories and think tanks and classrooms and legislatures and pop culture. Why would anyone want to turn to some confession of the 17th century? Or the 14th, or the 13th, or worse, turn to ancient scriptures. I mean really old stuff, to find guidance for what to believe or to do today. Stick with what's new. Stick with what's current, like the teenager who protests. I can't wear that. It's so 2013. The past has to be rushed through. We got more important things to get on to. The new, the brand new. Well, as soon as it's brand new and is here, it's old. That's how we live. That's how we've come to think. We have this anti-past bias. And so Christian historic biblical theological faith seems odd. It's obsolete, out of sync and out of touch, because it's historic. Means it's rooted in the past revelatory redemptive acts of God. And because it's biblical, It's expressed in old tellings and old writings. And it's theological. It's set in classical truth claims about God and all things in relation to God. And so when I insist that being the church means that we go back to that tradition and get our bearings, it just sounds strange too. It goes against everything we've ever heard or thought or assumed or lived or known or ever done. And it's counterintuitive. Wait a minute, the future's that way. Why are you going that way? I have a sense of GPS direction here, and this goes against that. Recalculating. The future's in front of us, not behind us. Go straight ahead toward it. Why would you want to turn around and go back as though you have forgotten something important? Who would do that? And so this explains why the church is little more than a narrow footpath and is not part of the thoroughfare system running through the Western modern world. Now, what I'm talking about is not the path of sentimental nostalgia. Let's return and live back there. Those were much better, simpler times. We can't do that. Nor is this the path of militant fundamentalism or jihadism, which says, let's force the world to live under the harsh rule of our ancestors. But I'll also tell you that neither is this the path of secular progress, which says, forget the past, forget the present. Everything just keeps getting better and better, and if we're going to be better, we got to leave everything, even if it requires the revolutionary deconstruction of everything that we've ever known. Neither ways is a way of the church. For faith neither regresses nor progresses. Quit thinking in those terms. It doesn't regress and it doesn't progress. It abides in the presence of God, who is before time, beyond time, who creates time and makes himself present and known in time and in all of time's times or seasons. I know it sounds strange to us who have to be temporal. And by the way, that's what human beings have to be. We have to live in this time. And which means we live one time at a time. And yet, God gives the church its past. God gives the church its present. And God gives the church its future, all at the same time. The resurrection of Jesus happened in the first century. That's long ago. But it remains or abides the key event of our faith, just as the Exodus is for the Jews. But the resurrection of Jesus was the inbreaking of the future kingdom of God, coming in time ahead of its time, the waves and effects of which continue today, and we experience them in baptism, the Lord's Supper, and Christian existence. The present, which is actually the past, which is actually the future. You got it? So to be cut off from the past is to be cut off from our future. To be cut off from our past is to be cut off from our future. That's why the church makes a continually joyous return to the gospel and to the scriptures and the theological consensus that developed around and out of and because of the prior speech acts of God in time and place. We're not left as orphans to discover our own truth for ourselves. We don't have to decide what we're going to be when we grow up or come up with something to do or figure out what future we want the future to be. We already have it. You can't invent what has already been invented. We have already been given our identity and existence as the church. We already have our calling. We already have our commission. There already is a basic content and framework to our faith. It has defined and directed the church through the ages in whatever time or season the church finds itself, yesterday, today, and yes, it will be that tomorrow. Maybe a common illustration will help. Congregations everywhere today, as you know, are struggling with worship. And it frequently erupts into what are called worship wars in the congregations. Now, the standard route is to give out a survey and ask members what they want. It's like a waitress coming to your table and taking orders. What would you like your worship to be? Do you lean toward more traditional or contemporary? Do you like yours contemplative or jazz or cowboy or just plain wide open? What would you like today in your worship order? What that means is that the future of worship in that congregation, and even the future of that congregation, is grounded in and solely dependent on the present. The present mood, trends, styles, individual preferences and taste. I want to propose another way to go in this question about worship. No one ever considers it. No one ever takes this way, but I'll go ahead and propose it. Don't begin with the question, what's next? What's ahead? What do we do now? What do y'all think we ought to be going with our worship? Don't let that be the lead question or lead the congregation. Instead, here's the lead question and the question that ought to lead the congregation. What's worship? Just honestly ask that question. And don't turn outward to popular culture and don't turn inward to personal piety or personal desires. Turn back to our own historic biblical theological tradition and ask that question. The church, what's worship? How strange that is. I mean, who would have thought of that to look there in the past? That the future of worship would be there and has already been given in the past. And yet, that's the church. I tell you, it lives in time differently than everybody else. Involve the whole congregation in this process. Invite and introduce everyone to a much larger, a much greater experience and expression of the whole people of God. Not just ourselves and a myopic kind of existence, but rather, what's the church and what's the worship of the church? And we enter into the wake that occurred in the great acts of God when the people learned the first movements of faith and how to worship. And they had to struggle with both religious and pagan idolatries. And they had to come to some distinctive, faithful way of practicing their worship of God. That doesn't mean that we would go like archaeologists and dig up some neat little tidbits and trinkets and artifacts to bring back here to add to and adorn and enhance what we call our worship experience. What I'm saying is the church, as the church, already has worship. And so the church present needs to be reminded, needs to relearn, needs to be guided and shaped. We need to join Jesus and his disciples and then the early communities and the church historic and universal in their worship. That we actually become part of the church that is worshiping. It's the same with prayer. It's not you just pray and come up with what you want to. How has the church prayed? How did Jesus teach his disciples to pray? You return. Your future is in that. It's the same thing with prayer. It's the same thing with forgiveness, with marriage, with ministry, the whole life and practice of the people of God. And of course, the objection is very strong. Who has the time or energy or interest for any of that? We got to get on with meeting present needs and figure out where we're going. But I don't budge. I'm just sorry, I do not budge. Because I see congregations having plenty of time and plenty of energy and interest. It's just not for the Christian worship tradition or prayer tradition or whatever. Because everybody's so busy trying to figure out what their future is going to be. And what happens in congregations struggling with worship is they end up not only in multi-generational conflict. It begins to be pitted against the old and the new, old people and young people. And they end up with multiple worship services thinking that's going to help. And then what they end up with is multiple congregations, and they end up with some other future than that of the church. And in which the Christian tradition plays no constructive role in their faith, in their practice, because nobody knows it. And nobody cares to find out. So the best direction I can give for what's ahead and what's next is back to the future. I don't see how congregations can continue. I don't see how Christians can continue much longer in the present or in the future the way they are going. With so little knowledge and understanding and practically no connection with or interest in the historic biblical theological faith tradition. And so what is required? In fact, I'm going to be even stronger. What is imperative is a huge redirection. Where we're headed and where we're going has to be turned around, which incidentally is the core meaning of the word repentance. It means to turn around, to return. And this will always be a bold, courageous, counterintuitive, countercultural move, which is next to impossible for people to make. In other words, it's like saying, well, where we're going has to be turned around. We have to go back to the sources that give us identity and give us life so we can rediscover and relearn and be regenerated. And more than anything else, this will require, as we move ahead, it will require a major educational effort. And us being a teaching, learning community, and every other congregation entering a major educational effort in being a teaching, learning community. I don't see how we can proceed without it. Because again, we're moving into a future that is not that of the church. And what that means is, not we're just going to add more Sunday school classes or a church study course or two or a more, and I know many of you belong to a Bible sharing group. It's not just adding more and more pieces like this. In fact, we've all been so much a part of all of those pieces for so long that it actually contributes to and does nothing to defeat biblical illiteracy and theological ignorance. I mean, it's just rampant in our congregations. I used to think that we had a fighting chance, but I've concluded that it's standard, it's universal, that's just it. We're now starting from scratch in theological education in our congregations. We just participated in activities for so long that have done absolutely nothing but contributed to the problem, not the solution. The local congregation must once again intentionally be a community formed by and for learning and study. The whole community. Not just part of the community, but the whole community. And everything about the community. Making it a kind of school in the ancient future faith that is ours. And everyone's a student and everyone's a disciple. Seriously, intentionally, and depthly involved. In every congregation I have served, I have always pulled aside a few. Now, whoever would come, but only a few came. But I would pull aside a few, and I would teach them. Now, when I first started doing that, I did not know that I was doing it. It's just that I fell into it, and I did it, and I just continued to do it. In every congregation I've ever served, I just had this simple idea that now that I'm in this, I probably ought to know what I'm in. And maybe other people needed to know it too, if they're in it. And so I taught. And as I said, only three or four came. Beth was in the very first group that I taught when I was a senior at Clemson. I just figured I could get some young people together, high schoolers, and we'd study, we would learn. Really starting from scratch. I didn't know anything. But I just figured that we needed to. I remember us bringing in the associate pastor. He was a recent graduate of New Orleans Baptist Seminary. He was a follower of Karl Barth, whom I had no idea who Karl Barth was, the greatest theologian of the 20th and probably multiple centuries. But I had no idea at that time. But I just thought, maybe this guy knows something. We'll bring him in just to talk to us. And of course, then the whole youth group dissipated. And that left just a handful of us. And Beth was in that group. I have always, even though I didn't know what I was doing, and sometimes even that I was doing it, I continued. I've discovered over the years there is no longer any teaching office in the church. We do not prepare and train teachers. We don't even do it in seminaries. We don't train them. If we train a teacher, that teacher is going to go to the academic community and not to the local congregation. And we don't really have teachers anymore. We really have to struggle to get somebody to take it. And, you know, get a warm body to prepare the lesson, so to speak. And we go through this exercise that I've already been critical of. But when I read and studied, I would pick up something in the classroom. I would rush over the Ohio River to that little group of three or four in that blue-collar church that I was in Jeffersonville, Indiana, and I would tell them. And then I'd go back. And then I'd come back and tell them. And I made so many mistakes. I didn't get it right. I mispronounced words. But I would just go and kind of like going and get food. I'd come and bring it back, and again, there was just a little handful who would take it. And I did that in Greensboro, I did it in Charlottesville, and I've done it here in Richmond. But I have never been in a teaching-learning community. The five congregations I served before this one were thankfully tolerant of me. And they allowed me to do my little thing on the side as long as I finished my other chores and didn't steal members from their Sunday school classes. And it was piecemeal. Again, I would do this class over here, and I would go do this little class over here. And everybody viewed it as, well, that's just Keith's hobby. You know, it's like some people have trains as a hobby, and other people have collecting comic books as a hobby. Well, Keith's got this little strange hobby, and he's got a few people around him who'll be weekend hobbyists with him. We'll let him do it. There are people who just happen to be in that sort of thing. Besides, we're all things to all people. We can allow that. Again, as long as he is doing his job, we'll let him do it on the side. But it will never be the main fare of the congregation. And so, after all these years, all these decades, I'm left wondering, as I told you last Sunday, is the church possible? I'm seriously struggling with that. Is the church possible? And this morning I add, is the local congregation any longer capable of being the church oriented to and by its own distinctive historic biblical theological tradition? Is that even possible? And to me it's more than a question, it's an endeavor. It's a ministry. Actually, I've been asking it, just not as strongly, but I've been asking it my entire ministry career. And the answer is not real clear or real evident, but I think it is. And I don't think it should have to be defended, though we have to defend it. I mean, it's kind of like pro football teams. Congregations are like that. When they come together and you start talking about football, they go, "What are you talking about? Where'd you get that?" That should not be. Then You're a pro football team. What are you doing? What game are you playing? Do you think you might ought to go back to the classroom? And the response is, why? We don't need to do that. Everybody's happy. We're playing a good game. And we've got a lot of people coming as fans in the stands. Will Christians ever become students again? Disciples of Jesus and the church again, and be taught? And with that, will they be trained specifically what I believe is the real challenge of the church today? And it is universal, it is major, it is huge. Will the church discern the truth? And in discerning the truth in and through the gospel of what God has done in Jesus Christ, will the church be able to courageously and convincingly speak in a world that is now full of truths and of faiths and religions and spiritualities and ideas and ideologies, and all of them are in conflict? Do you know the clash of these ideas and ideologies competing to narrate and control the world? It's more than just extreme jihadism, though that's a good example. It's much more than that. We're in a time in which everything is up in the air and has come loose, and the truth. Is the church able to proclaim the truth that has been made known to it? Is the church even able to know it anymore? I view our community as a rare opportunity to answer these questions differently by moving ahead, by going to the past. Our calling is not to come up with something that is novel or fresh or acceptable, but to present who we are and how we live as a community what the church has affirmed from its beginning. It does involve repentance, which has always been the first move of the church, and taking a different route. So how do we do that? How do we move ahead? In 2 weeks, there will be the resumption of Bible study on Sunday mornings at 9:45. I will be teaching the adults what I consider to be basic and essential to our biblical theological faith. But this is what's new. Jacqueline will be taking what I will be teaching and what we'll be learning and translate it into teaching for the older children. Be taking the same material. I've never done this before. I'm excited about trying it. I'm excited about seeing how this can be worked out. And not only that, but Melanie and Emily will then take what Jacqueline is doing and take some of that teaching to our younger children, and which makes all of us a teaching learning community. And what also is very exciting is that we have these three who will be teachers as they continue to be students. And I sincerely believe that there are others of you that are moving very close to being ready to be teachers. How do we get you teaching? Last March, six of us began meeting in a biblical studies program. It meets here at the Resource Center now on Monday nights. Participating from our congregation are Jacqueline Aronson, Jim and Joan McKinney, Ed Coleman, and June Wise. And there's another a person from another congregation, Paula Moody. So there are six students and me meeting together every week, and we've been doing that. This is a new program, as I said. Just being created, I'm very proud of that because New Community is the host. It's the pilot site of this 40-week biblical studies project in partnership with the John Leland Seminary. What I'm doing is preparing all the teaching notes, and I'm going to end up with between 250 and 300 pages of this, and I'm doing it unit by unit, of course. But coming behind me is another group in Virginia Beach. They began this past fall, and I'm passing on the teaching notes. I'm passing on the student outlines to that group. They're coming along behind, and I'm working with ministers in the Middle Peninsula and in the Charlottesville area to begin two other groups. Over in the Middle area, there's an association that has started to inquire, and I've met with them a couple of times about it, and I'm hoping they'll be coming along at some point. But our group here will finish in April, and so I'm asking the question, what's next? How do we move forward? What do we do? And I don't want to move that and then move what we're doing on Sunday morning and then move our worship. What I'm trying to grasp is how all of this can tie together and how we can add to it and expand it. How we can become this full-blown, full-bodied teaching-learning community. It's not just, again, piecemeal, but it's a whole concerted, intentional effort. And I'm also wondering who else. I've always been aware of and always been keen to the fact that scattered throughout all of the congregations are that one or two, three. Again, each congregation I've served, I've pulled them out. But they're scattered all through, and even outside the congregations, people who've left congregations. There are those who have this bent toward loving the Lord God with their mind. They're thoughtful people. They're intelligent. But there's nowhere that is offered. There's nowhere that that is cultivated. That there are people who want to learn. I'll be honest with you. There just comes a point where you just can't keep trying to work with entire large congregations as I've worked with in the past. You're going to have to bring to smaller groups who actually do want to learn, who want to be taught, and to become teachers. Many of them. Don't worry, you don't have to become a teacher. But this is so needed, desperately needed. And again, it is counterintuitive and countercultural, going against everything congregations are about. But there are so many other people. Who are they? Who do you know? Who fits this description? How do we bring them together? There's so much opportunity here and so much need. How do we, given who we are, given what we're about, know them, involve them? I'm confident that God's Spirit is working in people's lives, bringing them to a community of faith that is learning that faith. Now, I'm not just interested in expanding the congregation, but only in this way and in developing this. I have some thoughts and ideas about it, but they're not fleshed out and they're not really clear. If you're interested in this and you want to discuss these things, then I encourage you to get in touch with me because I can pull a number of us together and we can continue this conversation. We don't have time to do it on Sunday mornings, but we can continue the conversation. I really seriously want to know how this can be developed. You can tell, and I'm sure this is not brand new to you. Pretty much anything I said last week or this week is not. But this is what I most care about and I'm most interested in and always have been. It's just that now with you, I have an opportunity. I actually have enough freedom to pursue it. I'm not just invested in the Christian faith itself, but I'm invested in a community that is built around that faith. And that's where I'm headed. That's where I'm going. I have always been committed to it, but now there's an urgency. And a large part of the urgency has to do with time. I've been at this a long, long time. And you know, I'm closer to no longer being at it than I was when I first started. Now, another way to put that is, I don't have all the time in the world anymore, like I did when I was 20 and 30. And God called me then. I knew it early on to the local congregation, not to the academic community. He called me to come and teach specifically the Christian faith. That has never changed. And today I am as interested, motivated, energized, inspired, and Beth will tell you, intense about this as I was when I first heard the word eschatology and learned what it meant. I am committed to the church as the teaching and learning community. And I want to see that. A couple of months ago, a rumor was going around that I had said back in 2010, when all of this got started, that I would only be with New Community for 5 years and then I would retire. Well, that would mean this year. It would be 5 years. Well, first of all, I never said that, and I never thought that. I used to put timetables on things. Like when I went to Charlottesville, I said, I'm going to probably be here 5 years, and I was there 20. I'm not good at that, and so I just don't do much of that anymore. But I will tell you that while I am committed to this community and I'm committed to this teaching, learning, faith community, I'm also wondering about retirement. And I thought I would bring it up. Of course, it's dependent on you and your grace. In large part, this is a relationship. And also, it's dependent on factors such as the continuation of my good health and the avoidance of death. However, there will come a time when I will retire as your pastor. I don't have any plans to do that as such. I've told you what I plan to be about, but I will never retire from my teaching writing ministry. I will never retire from that ministry until my mind is shot or I am out of breath, literally. Now, don't worry, I plan to leave you before either one of those two things happens. And if you see one I'm beginning to happen, how about give me a little heads up on it? Let's make a pact. As the time approaches, I will let you know in plenty of time, and you let me know. Let's talk. There's no reason to be secretive or private. We'll approach it together, as it should be, and we'll talk openly about it, and we'll help one another discern the will and timing of God. What's best for the congregation, what's best for me involved in it as we move through the transition. But I will tell you, when I do retire, you will continue, and I hope you will carry on the work that we have begun and put in place. Some of you have asked me about the prospects of the next pastor. If you want just any regular pastor, a good one, you will have plenty of resumes. If you want a bad one, you will have even more resumes to choose from. But if you want a pastor who is a serious student and teacher of the faith, not a clone of me, but from the same rare breed, and it is rare. I've always told you that. I eat, sleep, and drink around ministers my entire life, and it's very rare to find one who is a serious student and teacher of the faith. But if you want that, which I hope you do, someone who will be excited about this, capable and committed enough to carry forward the theological church that is here, it is unlikely that you will find him or her in that stack of resumes. You'll have to go out and search. Like the proverbial needle in a haystack, I might add. Now, I'm already asking around. I'm putting the word out. But there will have to be a deliberative effort, and it will take some time when that time approaches. But be assured, what is key is that you be clear and confident about your identity and purpose. That has to be in place. And then you'll be able to communicate that, and you will have a very good chance of finding the right match. Match is all important. That person does exist just as surely as you exist. Though that person is probably thinking, that kind of congregation is impossible. Just as you're thinking, that kind of person is impossible. God has given His church all through the ages the direction, the ministry it needs if the churches will receive it. You'll go right on being the church. But meanwhile, you and I have time, though it will never be enough time, We have a time with a lot to learn and a lot to do and a lot to enjoy and a lot to be thankful for. This is the opportunity of the church.